Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our second series that we're doing on the war in Vietnam and its veterans. And our guest today is Robert Dugoni, who is an author of many books. I don't want to be too gushing on this, but my wife talked me into this, and she said, this book is so good, you've got to read it. And so that's the reason. And then I got a hold of Robert, and he was gracious enough to appear on the show. He's done, sold more than 25 million books. And that's a lot of books stacked up, and in 25 different countries. And you know what your sales are for this book so far, The World Played Chess?
I'm sorry, say
do you know how again? Many? Do you know how many of these books you've sold?
I'm guessing that we're close to 100,000.
Wow.
Right now, yeah.
Wow. Well, I know that it's hard to get at the library, that's for sure. So, that's good for you, right? When they're hard to get at the library, so you just need to buy more copies. And also, I just wanted to say too, Robert, one of the best recommendations that I've heard on this book, even though my wife is very bright and astute, I would say that it came from the veterans that I've worked with, probably done interviews with 25 different veterans. And the one thing that they really felt good about this book was that it was, even though it's a novel, it was very, the language was very authentic. The thoughts of the, of the characters were very authentic. Tell me about the research that you did on this book, The World Played Chess. What is the research that you did? That must have taken a long time.
It did take a long time. I started out with the concept that I was going to write this story about the summer of 1979 when I graduated high school and went to work on a construction crew, and I did work with two Vietnam veterans. And so a lot of the stories that they talk about, that they tell when they break for work every day, were stories that I could remember being told by the two guys that I worked with. But it was really my son who read an early draft of the book and came to me and said, you know, Dad, I don't really know what happened in Vietnam, and I'd like to know more about why the characters that he works with are the way that they are. You know, I'd like to know more about what happened to that war. Nobody talks about that war. And, you know, he's right. There are a lot of people that wouldn't talk about it. And Oliver Stone sort of began to change that a little bit when he started making movies. So, you know, what I did was I called up a friend of mine who was a gunny sergeant in the Vietnam War, Bob Mannion, really a good guy. He's 81 now. And I asked Bob, you know, he was a Marine. I said, can you help me? Because the character of William is also a Marine. And I'd like to know where the Marines were, what they were kind of doing and all that stuff. And Bob said he would help me, and he'd try to find some people that would also help me. But he really didn't have a lot of luck. He couldn't get people to talk to me. He even had a brother-in-law that was a pilot, in Vietnam, and he just did not want to talk about it. So I went to the next best thing, which is, you know, a lot of people began to write about their experiences in Vietnam. And so I probably read 10 to 15 firsthand accounts of young men who spent their time in Vietnam. And what I was really looking for is I was looking for the guys who were really in the soup, if you will, the guys who were really in the bush.
And boots on the ground.
Yeah, boots on the ground and what it was like on a daily basis. There's a lot of great books out there. It's interesting because when I started that, I suddenly remembered that in 1981, Mark Baker wrote a book called Nam. And I bought it back in 1981. And I went and I found it, and I still had it. I still have it. And I was able to go through it. And what that was it's an excerpt of like hundreds of Vietnam veterans who spent time in the bush, or nurses, car mechanics, all these different guys and all their different experiences. So when I'm researching, I continue to do research until the story starts to repeat itself. And once the story starts to repeat, then I begin to feel like I'm toward the end. So in addition to reading the books, I also watched all the movies, you know, all the ones that are out there, Full Metal Jacket, Platoon, you name it, I probably saw it. And I also watched Ken Burns' documentary, just to get a better sense of, you know, the politics and all those things. So you know, probably took me a good, you know, 3 to 4 months before I felt like I had enough material that I felt comfortable that I could, in addition to my own personal experience, I could write a journal that that made sense.
You know, it's interesting, too, is that that's exactly what I've found in interviewing these vets, is that some are almost want to talk about it. Some don't want to talk about it at all. And one young man that I was, he's an old guy like me now, but I went to high school with him. And he played the interview that I did with him for his wife and his kids and his grandkids. And he said that was the first time he'd ever really discussed that in, you know, in his life. And I think that we need to hear these stories. Talk about the main characters. Talk about Vincent, and tell me about the characters in this story.
So Vincent is an adult now. He's in his either late 40s or early 50s, and he has his own son that's getting ready to start his summer, his senior year in high school, as well as a daughter. And he and his wife live in a town in Northern California, and the book opens with him receiving a package in the mail, and he opens it up, and it's a journal, and it's William's journal. And William is one of the two Vietnam veterans who Vincent worked with that summer of 1979. And the very short letter that William sends basically says, I didn't know who to send this to. My wife is gone now, and I'm a platoon of one. So I thought about sending it to you about that summer of 1979. He said, you saved my life. I don't know if you know that, and I think you should. All I ask is that you read this journal in the order that I wrote it so you'll understand. And so Vincent knows that in 1979, William had PTSD. He didn't know he had PTSD, and Vincent didn't know he had PTSD, but he just sort of went off the rails and ended up going away. And Vincent never really had the opportunity to find out what happened to William. He just sort of disappeared. And so this journal, Vincent deduces, will be something that will explain to him, you know, what happened to William. He was also working with a second man who was running the construction crew, and that was a guy named Todd. He also was a Vietnam vet. He was an Army vet. So those are the sort of the main characters. But the other main character is Bo, who is Vincent's son, who's 18, who's, you know, getting ready to start his senior year in high school and go off to college. And the journal sort of becomes an instruction manual on going from being a boy to being a man. And Vincent uses it and the stories that he remembers from that summer to try to counsel his own son so that his son won't make the same mistakes that he made as a young man. And it's sort of the point of the book, that it's really not so much a book about Vietnam as it is a book about coming of age. And you know, it's that moment in a lot of young men's lives where we go from being boys to being men, and yet there's really no instruction manual. Nobody takes you in your senior year and gives you a class on, you know, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a husband, what it means to be a father. You graduate and you either go on to college or you go out into the workforce, or in this particular instance, you get drafted.
Yes.
And you know, you go off a boy, but you're supposed to be a man.
And it is interesting too. I think when we talked yesterday, I mentioned that probably half of the males in my graduating class in 1966 in Ellensburg were going to go off and be farmers with their fathers. And when the draft, of course, the draft was there, and they didn't have college deferments, and they went right off. One young man, Alan Aronica, young Native American kid, you know, from June of 66, 4 or 5 months later, he was in Vietnam in the heat of things and in a jungle. I guess my next question is it's not silly, but it's, you know, I had it written down here. I said, what part of you do you put in the books? And it's pretty obvious right now when you tell me that it is about you, and it is about even some of your life experiences, you know, with working with that construction crew.
Yes, some of them. I mean, I think the thing that readers need to understand is that all characters are of the author.
Right.
Whether you're writing fiction, or in my case, you're writing, in some instances, you're writing, you know, narrative nonfiction. But that all characters are of the author. And you know, so what I did is I took that summer and I fictionalized it. But there's a lot of truth in that summer, because if I'm not writing about what I know, I'm trying to write about what I'm interested in and do the proper research so that it becomes real. Because what I want most of all when people read my books is I want people to say to me, is this a true story? Did this really happen? Because I know that if I can get readers to think that and they ask those questions, then I know that the book meant something to them, that they could feel it on a visceral level.
And there are some things in the book that just, you know, where I can feel that, where you're talking, and it's like, again, when we talked, you know, we talked about, you know, Elvis dying, and there are certain things in our lives that we can remember where we were, what we were doing, you know, that just strike us. And I think that, again, is another really positive thing about the book. It is, you mentioned, you know, moving from being a young person to a man. And there is no book like the Dr. Spock book. Remember, everybody listened to or did the Dr. Spock book in the 1950s, How to Raise Children. Boy, that would, anybody that's raised children know you can't do it with a book. And yeah. I, you know, another thing that I appreciated in just reading this and listening to some of the interviews with you is that you really are a family man. You mentioned you have 10 brothers or 10?
Nine siblings.
Nine siblings. Wow.
Five brothers.
Wow. Wow. That's a bunch. I'm an only child, so I've been spoiled rotten all my life. But I did find out later in my life that I had I was adopted, and I found out later that I had two biological brothers and seven half brothers. My mother was quite productive.
Wow.
How have you changed because of this book?
You know, I think that I. You know, if I go back to 1979, that was really sort of a pivotal moment in my life. It's really one of the reasons why I decided to make this my second literary novel. You know, I was thinking of an idea of what I might do, and you know, it really was a pivotal moment in my life, because I learned that I didn't know anything. I mean, I grew up in a bubble. I grew up in a wonderful family in a wonderful hometown. You know, there was no crime. You know, that was It was lily white, and I mean that literally. You know, I think
sure.
I had one African American kid in my entire class. So I just didn't know anything. I was naive. You know, I was naive to the ways of the world, I guess is what I would say. And so, you know, that moment, you know, going to work on that construction crew and working with two guys that had not only seen a lot more of the world, but, you know, had to ask themselves every morning if this was going to be their last day on the planet, was an incredibly sobering experience for me. And so, you know, going back and writing this book was not an easy thing for me to do, simply because, you know, I had to go back to that time and acknowledge, you know, when I was really innocent, when I was really naive, and how that moment changed me. But I think that as I developed the journal in particular, and developed William in particular, what I really came to understand is that, is what I said at the beginning of the book, is every person that served in Vietnam is a hero. Every one of them, every single one of them,
right,
is a hero. And you know, we need to honor them for what they did over there. And, you know, no, they might not have stopped the Nazis from, you know, taking over the world, and they may not have you know, stopped, you know, all those things, but they were, that wasn't their fault.
Right.
You know, what they did regardless was they went and they served their country. And, I don't think their country was honest with them after reading that, after the research that I did, but they served their country and they did their duty. And that's really, I think, what we need to honor and always remember.
You know, I think that, and I also interviewed two young men who were conscientious objectors, and they went into Vietnam as medics. And one of the guys said he refused to carry a gun, and they finally really got into the stuff very deep into the battles, and his captain made him carry, they found an old Russian rifle that he didn't even think shot, but they said that he had to carry it kind of for his own protection.
Right.
You know, but I think you're right. I mean, when I ask people, how did they feel about going into Vietnam, most of them did not know what to expect. They had no idea, even if they trained in Florida, and I think they trained in the Okefenokee Swamp there, you know, learning about jungles. They had no idea what punji sticks were. They had no idea what booby traps were out there. And it was a very strange war from that aspect of it. I ask you, one of the questions we talked about a little bit too was, I said, what terrifies you, if anything, or makes you feel helpless or hopeless?
You know, I don't know that I ever feel helpless or hopeless. I think that, my friend who the gunny sergeant, Bob Mangan, he was very, I thought he was very poignant. When I started researching this book, COVID was in its grip on the United States, and everyone was home, and no one could travel, no one could, you know, go out of their house, no one could go to the grocery store. I mean, it was really one of those moments in life that I never ever expected or thought would happen. I just never even entered my conscience. You know, my son came home, my daughter came home. Their lives were really upended. My life was not that upended because, you know, I'm a writer. I work from home. I could go out and go for a run or whatever, you know. And but their life was tremendously upended. And I was saying that to my friend Bob, and he didn't chuckle, but he said to me, you know, everything is a matter of perspective, Bob. Imagine what it was like to be one of those men in the jungle for 13 months, and every single day you didn't know if it was going to be your last. Imagine what it was like during the World War II to be living in an occupied country for 10 years, you know. And so, you know, everything is really, I think, a matter of perspective. So I never give up hope. the thing that terrifies me is probably the thing that terrifies all parents, and that's if anything were to happen to either of my two children. That scares me more than anything.
I agree. I can't have, you know, and we talked, I remember one time that I had to take my daughter to the doctor, and she had an ear infection, and of course, I was trying to hold her, and she was crying and everything, and I remember, and I was almost in tears myself, and I remember the doctor saying to me, you fathers are such big babies, and I thought, you know, that's kind of a compliment, you know.
Yeah.
It shows that I actually do have feelings, and that, I did do my share of changing diapers and those kinds of things, and I also look at my question and I say, you know, I really don't, you're right, I really don't feel hopeless about anything. I feel bad about things and people that I'd like to help that I really can't, or also tell me about I love the title of the book, The World Played Chess. It talks a little bit about it in the preface, but explain to me the title of the book.
Well, I had gone down to Palm Springs, and I was my buddy Dale was asking me, you know, what are you working on? And I said, well, I have this idea, and I told him the idea, and he said, oh, it's sort of like that old saying, the world played chess. And I looked at him, and I said, I don't know that saying. What saying? He said, you know the saying. It's the world played chess while I played checkers. In other words, you're not even playing the same game that the other people are playing. That's how naive you are. And I went, wow, that's exactly what I am I'm trying to do here. And, you know, one of the humorous parts of this whole experience for me was I put that in the book. I put the world played chess, and then inside I put the world played chess while I played checkers. And I attributed it to my friend Dale. And when I turned the book in, my editor said, who the heck is Dale Walker? And I said, what? That's my buddy. She said, well, you can't attribute this to him. I said, why not? It's unattributed. And he's the one that said it to me. And she's like, Well, no, it has to. You have to leave it as unattributed. So I didn't get to give my buddy Dale a credit in the quote in the front of the book. So I put it in the back of the book.
Yeah. I you know, the way that I took it, and, you know, kind of having lived through that entire, you know, era, when I first saw it, the world played chess, I really thought about the politicians, because so many of these vets said to me, you know, if the politicians had let us fight the war, it was a winnable war. I mean, the United States had so much firepower, but what they said was we were in Cambodia, but we weren't supposed to be in Cambodia. It was run by politicians, and it was kind of a political chess game, is almost the way that I looked at it when I read that, you know.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably, there's a lot of truth to that. At the same time, was it really a winnable war? You know, I don't know that in the history of the world any country has ever really lost a war in which they were being occupied, because, you know, that's one of the points that's made in the book is, you know, the people that live there, they got nowhere to go. So no matter where you look, you know, the old Soviet Union, the old Roman Empire, the old Attila the Hun, I mean, the British Empire, at some point, the people who live there are going to prevail because they don't have to go anywhere. And that's kind of what happened in Vietnam. Yes. They were in war for 40 years, but they weren't going anywhere.
Right.
So, you know, I think all of us can probably agree now that it was a war we should never have been in. But at the same time, I think we can all agree that you know, we've learned a tremendous amount about what happened over there, and hopefully we learn it so we never have to repeat it.
You know, I remember seeing the newsreels in the movie theaters, and they would always show this this domino effect, all these, you know, domino countries just falling down. And one of my friends, one of the vets said to me, he said, you know, the people in Vietnam that lived in these small towns, they didn't care if they were in a democratic republic. They didn't care if they were communists. All they cared about was if they, you know, where their next bowl of rice was coming from. And that's what they lived for. And I think you're right. I mean, I think even in, if we think about Ukraine right now, I mean, I don't think it's, you know, now they're saying, well, that's, you know, they're not, the Russian army is not moving as fast as they were planning on going. And I think that's because they are moving into an occupied country. Well, let's just get one, something kind of fun out of the way. What gets you up out of bed each day?
It sounds trite, and I know it sounds trite, but I love what I do. I truly love what I do, and I didn't always get to do it. I practiced law for many years, though my dream was always to be a writer, and so I understand what it means to get up every day and to go to work and to do a job that maybe you don't want to do, and what that feels like and how difficult that is. So I don't ever take a day for granted when I can get up and do what I love to do, because I know that there are so many people out there that don't get that opportunity. So, you know, for me to be able to get up every day and get to my computer and maybe get a workout in and then get to work and work hard enough. I live in the Pacific Northwest up here in Seattle, and it's light. You know, now it's light till 7 o'clock, and soon it'll be light till 9 o'clock.
That is nice. I mean,
I can work till 5 o'clock and go out on the golf course and play 18 holes.
Yeah.
So I never take anything for granted. I feel very blessed that I get to do what I love to do, and I hope that I can do it for a long, long time.
You know, my counselor, I was kind of a goof off in high school. I really was. And my counselor, Mr. Carlson, told me when you were kind of doing our last little things before we, in our senior year, he said, "Nurse, whatever you do, don't become a teacher." And that was exactly what I wanted to do, and that is exactly what I did for the next 50 years, you know. And in so many different situations, God, I loved working at the Women's Correctional Institution. I mean, what a slice of life, and the stories you hear. And it is nice to be able to do what you really, really want to do. And I also appreciate the fact that it sounds like you do care. We all care about our kids. We've had ups and downs with them, and I'm sure you're much younger than me. But you know, nobody gets through this life without a few bumps, and that's okay. We just kind of gotta roll with them. Are there any other points that I didn't discuss that you think I should discuss in this interview?
You know, the only thing that really jumps out at me is when the book first came out, I was asked to do an interview with a woman who was writing for a military magazine, and you know, one of the things she said to me was, "Do you see similarities between the Vietnam War and the war in Afghanistan?" Because when my book came out, it was when we had sort of that whole debacle, and we were, you know, pulling out of Afghanistan, and the Taliban couldn't get in fast enough, and all those poor Afghani people that, you know, worked for the United States diligently for 20 years, suddenly their life was in danger. And, you know, I don't really have any comment on that politically, but, you know, what I did say to her was that, you know, it's one of the reasons why we should do all that we can to avoid getting into a war.
Yes.
Because, you know, the bottom line at the end of the day it's the men and the women now, but it's the men back then and the men and women now who serve there, who pay the ultimate price. It's not us old people. It's not the politicians. It's the young people that have to pay the price. And that is a very, very heavy price. And we paid a very, very heavy price in Vietnam. We lost a whole generation of young men. And who knows what those young men might have done if they'd been given their lives, you know? Who knows what they might have invented, what cures they might have found, what their children might have done, and what their children, you know, there's so many what ifs. But I think the bottom line is it's such a heavy price that those young men and young women pay that it should be avoided at all costs.
And I really agree with that, and I think that just the concept of war of, you know, which side kills the most, the other side is, seems to me kind of a, not very much of a win-win situation. And so I think we're about ready to wrap this up, but I did make you a promise when we talked the other day, and that was that when my bourbon comes out of my 10-liter cask, I'm going to recontact you, and I'm going to bring some of that over and let you taste that. So
fabulous.
Yeah. Yep. We'll do it. And thank you very much. It's been wonderful. And thanks for appearing on our little radio station here in Fashion.
So, my pleasure.
You take care. Have a great day.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. We enjoyed it. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.